Well, we're glad to have you here this morning, and we pray the Lord's blessing on you as Brother Robert Bennett will talk to us about, you guessed it, the resurrection. Brother Robert.
Is this loud enough? Everybody can hear. Well, we'd like to welcome you all here today, and the Salem Bible Students Ecclesia would like to take this opportunity to thank all the friends and family that have come out here to join us. Our little class enjoys these opportunities to provide services to the brethren and to friends and family as a way of including everyone in our celebration of the ongoing fulfillment of the divine plan of the ages. We'd like to include our extended family in the blessings that we receive from our study of the divine plan of the ages. So this service is designed especially for you. Now, my job today is to present you with a Reader's Digest version of those things that we find in the Scriptures. And since today is the celebration of Easter, I thought we might take a closer look at something that is at the heart of today's celebration. Across the world today, millions of people are celebrating Easter, but most only have a small glimpse of what it really means. We are fortunate, though, because we've had an exposure to this wonderful blessing that we call the divine plan of the ages. Now, it's no secret that the Bible is a book not easily understood. Indeed, in the past, it's been greatly misunderstood. But now we see that this was actually an intentional part of the divine plan. Consider, for example, the fact that Jesus presented his message in parables and dark sayings. Matthew 13, verse 34 tells us, "Without a parable he spake not unto them." And listen to what God told the prophet Isaiah. "Say unto this people, hearing ye shall hear and not understand, and seeing ye shall see and not perceive. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and be converted and healed." Isaiah 6, verses 9 and 10. Now, why was this? We used to wonder why God would purposely obscure his message. But now we know that the eyes of their understanding were blinded because it was not yet time to heal the effects of sin. And so the depth and the beauty of the divine plan was hidden for a time and for a reason. In the meantime, all kinds of explanations and fanciful theories have been attributed to the Bible. But these theories could not hold our hearts because they did not ring true. Then, in due time, God gave us an expanded appreciation of his divine plan. It began to be understood with a clarity not seen since the days of the apostles. And in this opening of our understanding, we have found something that does ring true, that does hold our hearts. We have found a plan so broad and so complete that we stand in awe. In the words of Isaiah 25, verse 9, we say, "Lo, this is our God. We have waited for him." Now, you may have noticed that your family members who belong to the Salem Bible Students, and you know who they are, you may have noticed that last week they celebrated something which they called the memorial. And you may have noticed that this celebration was very important to them. Perhaps you wondered why. Why do the members of the Salem Bible Students celebrate the memorial while the rest of the world celebrates Easter? Well, if you were to ask one of the members of the class, they would tell you that the memorial is actually a celebration of the death of Jesus. It takes place on the same day as the Jewish Passover, the same day on which Jesus died. And you might remember that the Passover was an event immediately preceding the release of the children of Israel from slavery in Egypt. It was the Exodus. Now, we've come to learn that the Passover is much more than this. The Passover is a biblical type. That is, it's a biblical word picture. The Passover is really an illustration that was designed to show how the world would be redeemed through the blood of Christ. It's about the ransom of mankind through the death of Jesus. His blood was the blood of the Passover lamb sprinkled on the doorposts. Easter, on the other hand, is a celebration of the resurrection of Jesus. In the words of Romans chapter 1, verse 4, Easter is about how Jesus was declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 20 through 22, we learn that he was the first of many that will be resurrected. But now is Christ risen from the dead and become the firstfruits of them that slept. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. So then, Easter is more than just a celebration about the resurrection of Jesus. It's a promise from God about the future of mankind. Acts 3:19 tells us that there will be a time of refreshing that shall come from the second advent of Jesus. The Greek word translated refreshing literally means a recovery of breath, to breathe again. And Acts 3:21 calls that day the times of restitution of all things which God hath spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began. Indeed, when we go back and take another look at the message given by all his holy prophets, we find that yes, they have all indicated a time of blessing. God has provided the promise of restitution for mankind. This promise is at the heart of his divine plan. And both the death and the resurrection of Jesus were necessary and vital parts of that plan. So we ask, what is this resurrection and why is it so important? Well, first, let us notice that the Bible clearly indicates that there will be a resurrection. For instance, consider John 11:25, where Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. Or perhaps John 5, verses 28 and 29, where Jesus tells us, the hour is coming in which all that are in their graves shall hear his voice and shall come forth, they that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. Now in this verse, King James uses the phrase resurrection of damnation, but the Greek word translated here, damnation, really means a trial or testing to see what the outcome will be. In other words, it will be a resurrection by judgment, a resurrection by testing, an assessment to see who is worthy of continuing life and who is not. Now, the idea of judgment often contains a negative connotation, and sometimes the Bible does present it that way. But the Bible also presents the day of judgment as a cause for rejoicing, because the judgment leads mankind into a much better situation. Psalms 96, verses 11 and 13 tells us, let the heavens rejoice, and let the earth be glad. Let the sea roar in the fullness thereof. Rejoice before the Lord, for he cometh to judge the earth. He shall judge the world with righteousness, and the people with his truth. This idea of judgment or testing is not something new. We've seen it before. In the Genesis account, Adam and Eve were tested in the Garden of Eden. They were tested to see if they were worthy of continuing life, but they failed. And because of that failure, they and the unborn race within them were given the sentence of death. That is, they were judged unworthy of continuing life. And since then, each member of the human race has continued to fail for two reasons. First, they were born in an imperfect condition and did not have the ability necessary to keep God's commandments perfectly. And second, the world has been estranged from God and under the control of Satan, so that they could not gain the knowledge, the experience, or the faith necessary to keep God's commandments. But during the resurrection, these two problems will be fixed. This is why the Bible speaks of restitution as well as resurrection. As one would not expect a teacher to give an exam on the first day of class, students need to be taught first, and then they can be examined. Likewise, in the resurrection, mankind will first be given the knowledge and the ability necessary to pass that test. Earlier, we mentioned that in Acts 3:21, it spoke about a time of restitution of all things. And when we consider the original Greek for the word restitution, we find that it would be better translated reconstitution. It comes from the idea to restore, which of course means to bring something back into its original condition. So we have the promise that mankind will be brought back into a condition of perfection, just as Adam was before the fall. Micah chapter 4, verse 8 calls this a return to the first dominion. That is the dominion that mankind possessed before the fall. Then, in due time, each individual of the human race will be tested, just as Adam was. Only they will have an advantage over Adam. Because when Adam was tested, the existence of sin and evil and death was merely academic. But for us, well, we're very aware of sin and evil and its consequence. Each of us has experienced both sides of sin and evil. Each of us has been treated in ways that were not right. And each of us has treated others in ways that were not right. Whether we're talking about war or crime, or even that guy that cuts you off as you are driving, the human race has a large body about what is right, of knowledge about what is right and what is wrong. Individually and collectively, we have seen the end result of sin. We've seen it go unchecked and even thrive. The prophet Jeremiah lamented this fact in Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 1. Wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? Wherefore are they happy that deal very treacherously? Yes, the history of the human race is the history of violence and war and aggression. No abuse, no exploitation, no deception has been left untried. No atrocity left unrivaled by some subsequent cruelty. Again, in the words of the prophet Jeremiah, they are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. But now, isn't it interesting that in the Garden of Eden, the tree from which the forbidden fruit was taken was called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? And in the title of this tree, we find a key element of the divine plan. We find the purpose of why God has allowed things to be the way they are, the reason for the permission of evil. The world continually questions why a God of love would allow bad things to happen to good people. But the divine plan tells us that since the fall of mankind has been learning a vital lesson about good and evil. However, mankind has only been given one half of that lesson which God intends to give. So here's a secret that not many people know. And that secret is that the lesson about good has not yet been given. The Bible tells us this lesson will be given during the period of time which we call the kingdom of Christ. Now, we've all heard about this kingdom. We pray for it every time we repeat the Lord's prayer. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Matthew 6:10. And you may have noticed that in this prayer, it's the first request that is made. It comes before asking for our daily bread. It comes before asking for our forgiveness. Acts chapter 17, verse 31 calls this kingdom a day of judgment. He hath appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men in that he raised him from the dead. That day is really the thousand-year reign mentioned in the book of Revelation. Sometimes we call it the millennium. It's the culmination of the activities of God since the fall of Adam. The purpose of the kingdom is to teach mankind a two-part lesson that we find enumerated in Luke chapter 10, verse 27. And here we take our wording from the Weymouth translation. Thou shalt love thy God with thy whole heart, thy whole soul, thy whole strength, and thy whole mind, and thy fellow man as much as thyself. This is sometimes called the golden rule. It's the lesson about treating others the way that you would like to be treated. People pay lip service to this rule now, but in the kingdom it will become law. Obedience to this law is one reason why the kingdom is called a time of refreshing in Acts 3:19. Because in the kingdom, mankind will find relief from their bondage to sin and evil and death. The prophet Haggai calls it the desire of all nations in Haggai 2:7. However, since a large percentage of mankind are in their graves, well, in order to be taught this two-part lesson, they will need to be resurrected. As the psalmist phrases it, Thou who hast shown me great and severe troubles will revive me again and bring me again from the depths of the earth. Psalm 71:20. Now, perhaps you remember a time when it was said in school that there were three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Well, in the Bible, there's also three R's, ransom, resurrection, and restitution. The memorial we celebrated last week was about the ransom. The celebration of today is about the resurrection, but the kingdom will be a celebration of restitution. So what will it be like in the mediatorial kingdom? Well, unfortunately, the Bible has very little to say about the physical aspects of the kingdom, and it has nothing at all to say about what kind of technology might be there. So I have no idea if there'll be personal jetpacks or robot maids. You're just going to have to wait and see. However, the Bible does have a lot to say about what we might call the social aspects of the kingdom. It tells us about the government of the kingdom and how its laws will operate with absolute justice and equity. In this present world, selfishness is the rule and righteousness is the exception. But in the incoming kingdom, righteousness, or in other words, doing that which is right, will be the rule and evil will be the exception. No more will we see some people long for want of a basic need, while others have more than they can possibly use. Disparity between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots, will no longer exist. Isaiah 40, verses 4 and 5 tells us, Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. The Bible also informs us about the health care system of the kingdom. There won't be one, because you won't need one. Job says that in the kingdom, the flesh of a man will be fresher than that of a child. He shall return to the days of his youth. Job 33:25. Consider also Isaiah 35, verses 5 through 7. Then shall the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame leap as a deer, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert. And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land shall become springs of water. Now they're both literal and symbolic fulfillments to this promise. The literal blind will have their eyes opened, but then so will those who see with their physical eyes, but do not perceive with their mental eyes. And in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 9, we find another item that will not be needed in the kingdom, homeland security. Because the prophet tells us, They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Of course, this verse also shows us what will be important in the kingdom: education. The knowledge of the Lord shall fill the earth as the waters cover the sea. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 14 echoes this sentiment. And the prophet Jeremiah adds to the thought, "And they shall teach no man every man no more every man his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord." Jeremiah 31:34. Yes, education will be important in the kingdom, because the primary purpose of the kingdom is to restore mankind back into harmony with God. And I do not need to tell you that both individually and collectively, mankind needs to unlearn some very bad habits. They need to learn how to think and act in ways that are in harmony with the golden rule. And this is not a small task. It will take the full 1,000 years to accomplish. And the Bible tells us that there are three distinct aspects to this work in the kingdom. These three aspects are illustrated by the three roles which Jesus, with the assistance of his bride, will perform. The three roles are: one, that of a king; two, that of a priest; and three, that of a mediator. Let's take a moment and consider these roles. Now, forgive me for pointing out the obvious, but the reason why a thousand-year reign is called a kingdom is because it will be ruled by a king, an autocrat, an absolute dictator. Psalms 22, verses 27 and 28, we read, "All the ends of the world shall remember and turn unto the Lord, and all the kindreds of the nations shall worship before thee, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he is the governor among the nations." In the book of Revelation, and also in Psalms, Jesus is said to rule with an inflexible rod of iron. The prophet Daniel tells us, "In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." And Isaiah tells us that "the nation and the kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted." Isaiah 60, verse 12. Now granted, the thought of a king or an autocratic dictator ruling over us grates against our American sense of freedom and democracy. But that worry is unfounded, because there's a difference in this kingdom. The difference that is that in this kingdom, the king is benevolent. The king is said to rule in righteousness, or as Hebrews 1, verse 8 phrases it, "A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of thy kingdom." And as a matter of fact, this king loved his subjects so much that he shed his blood in order to redeem them. So his kingdom is designed for their benefit, for their uplifting, for their restitution. And the reason why the kingdom will be a strict autocratic reign is also for their benefit. Mankind will not easily give up their self-centered ways. Absolute justice and equity will need to be enforced at first. So the freedom that will be restricted in the kingdom will be the freedom to do evil or to harm another in any way. Isaiah chapter 60, verse 18 tells us, "Violence shall no more be heard in thy land, wasting nor destruction within thy borders, but thou shalt call thy walls salvation and thy gates praise." And this is a point worth repeating. In the kingdom, no member of the human race will be allowed to cause harm to another. Now how's that for a precious promise? Wars and aggression will be forced to end. True peace, and not just the absence of war, will finally come to this planet. Isaiah 13, verse 11 says that he will cause the arrogance of the proud to cease. And in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4, "He shall judge among the nations and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." The psalmist echoes this promise. He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. Psalms 46, verses 9 and 10. Now, in another sense, there will be no peace in the kingdom. That is, there will be no peace in the sense that there will be no rest to eradicate the effects of sin and evil. Judgment also will I lay to the line, and righteousness to the plummet. And the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters shall overflow the hiding place. Isaiah 28, verse 17. So pick your favorite injustice. In the kingdom it will find a resolution. Racism? In the kingdom mankind will learn that there really is only one race, the human race. Global warming? The environment? Oil? In the kingdom, not only will mankind learn a proper stewardship over their environment, they will also learn that God has the power and the foresight to overrule the outcome of our previous abuses of this planet. In fact, the prophet Isaiah tells us that the desert shall bloom as a rose. And Psalm 67, verse 6, tells us that the earth shall yield her increase. Well then, what about corporate greed? In the kingdom, those who act selfishly will quickly learn that those methods will no longer work. In the kingdom, they will learn that acts of greed will not bring them gain, but rather suffering and chastisement. Selfishness, self-centered thinking will begin to decrease. Selflessness, concern for the welfare of others, will begin to increase. Mankind will begin to learn to love their fellow man as much as they love themselves. Isaiah 13, verse 12, teaches us that in the kingdom, human life will become more precious than gold. After a while of this enforced justice and equity, the majority of mankind will begin to see the value of a society based on that golden rule. They will begin to desire the ways of God out of a changed heart and not just a forced outward conduct. Listen to Psalms 37, verses 8 through 11. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil. For evildoers shall be cut off, but those that wait upon the Lord shall inherit the earth. For yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and it shall not be. But the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. Yes, in this kingdom, as the lessons are learned, good will prosper and evil will decline. Mankind will eventually come to love righteousness and hate evil. And then, as the psalmist says, the wicked shall not be. Either they will have changed their ways, or they will not be able to pass the judgment which leads to everlasting life. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end. Upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it, in order to establish it, and with judgment and with justice from henceforth, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Isaiah 9, verse 7. Now the second role that the Bible tells us that Jesus will perform in the kingdom is that of a priest, or of a high priest to be more exact, because the members of the body of Christ will act as under-priests. In the book of Hebrews, we read that Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek, and not after the order of Aaron. So what does this mean? Well, the Aaronic or Levitical priesthood performs sacrifices specified in the books of Exodus and Leviticus on a continual basis. They did them every year, year by year, without end. The Apostle Paul shows us that these sacrifices were typical. That is, they did not really accomplish anything, but were only intended to illustrate that one true sacrifice. And that one true sacrifice that Jesus made on the cross was effective. It actually accomplished the redemption of mankind. that sacrifice only needed to be given once. And then, as Hebrews 10:12 tells us, Jesus sat down at the right hand of the Most High. Now, as vital as this one true offering was, it was not the full extent of the office of high priest in the kingdom. The typical sacrifices in the book of Leviticus show us that the people also performed certain sacrifices. They presented offerings that represented their heart harmony with the arrangement of God. The typical priesthood accepted those sacrifices, and the people were blessed by them. Likewise, in the millennial kingdom, individuals will show their heart harmony with the new arrangement by making an offering to God. However, the sacrifice that they will offer will not be bulls and goats, as in the typical arrangement. Rather, they will offer their hearts in consecration to God. They will pledge to seek His ways. Their offering will be accepted by the high priest, and they will be blessed by it. But even this is not the end of the role of the high priest in the kingdom. Because in the Bible, the typical priesthood was required to educate the people about the contents of the law. And this will be true in the millennial kingdom also. The role of the high priest, with the help of the under priests, will be to educate the people about the law of the kingdom. So as a king, Jesus will govern, but as a high priest, His effort will be to educate and to uplift. And the third role that Jesus will perform in the kingdom is that of a mediator. Now, as we consider this office, we recall that a mediator is someone who stands between two parties who are at odds. A mediator deals with each opposing side individually so that the two parties do not have to deal directly with each other. And this is a vitally important part of the divine plan. Remember, God's standard is perfection. He has declared that anything that does not meet His standard will not be allowed to continue living. And since mankind is not perfect, since they cannot keep God's law without violation, God has provided a way to protect mankind for a limited time, until they're ready to face that examination given by absolute justice. That protection is provided by the mediator. He stands between the absolute justice of God and fallen mankind. He is responsible for giving mankind the time and the opportunity to develop the abilities that will allow them to keep the law of God without violation. And that opportunity will be offered during the 1,000-year reign of Christ, the millennial reign, the kingdom. And the mechanism that will accomplish this development is compared to a highway. In the Bible, we find mention of three different pathways that one might travel. In Matthew 7:13, Jesus calls the first path a broad road to destruction. Wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be that which go in thereat. This is the path which mankind is currently taking. It leads downward into sin and death, destruction, annihilation, non-existence. The second path is called the narrow way, and Jesus tells us that it's a difficult path to find, difficult to enter, and difficult to walk on this path. Straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. This is the path which the prospective members of the body of Christ walk today. As the broad road leads downward and takes little effort, the upward narrow way is difficult and requires a lifetime of struggle against the effects of sin. It's a life of opposition to those things which the world has to offer, and not all of them are evil. However, in the kingdom, both of these roads will be closed. Since the body of Christ will have been completed, the narrow way will exist no more. And the broad road to destruction will actually be very difficult to travel. It will require a persistent, intentional, willful resistance to the goodness of God in order to find that path. Instead, there will be a much easier road, which the Bible calls the highway of holiness. and highway shall be there, and a way. And it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err therein. When this highway is established, it will be easy to find, easy to travel, easy to progress. Isaiah says that even a fool will not err therein. And in subsequent verses to Isaiah 35:8, we read that no lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up thereon. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransom of the Lord shall return and come to Zion, with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. And they shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. In 1 Peter 5, verse 8, Satan is said to be a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. So when Isaiah tells us that no lion shall be there, we understand that the influence of Satan will be restricted. Revelation chapter 20, verses 1-3, tells us that during that thousand-year reign, Satan is to be bound and cast into a bottomless pit. He will not be able to deceive the nations anymore. And with the binding of Satan, the work of his hand will begin to fall apart. In Isaiah, we also read that there will be no stones to stumble those that walk on this highway. Go through the gate. Prepare ye the way of the people. Cast up the highway. Gather out the stones. Lift up a standard for the people. Behold, the Lord hath proclaimed unto the end of the world. Say ye to the daughter of Zion, behold, thy salvation cometh. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. Indeed, his work will be before him. It will take the full 1,000 years of the kingdom to bring mankind back into a condition of righteousness, the condition of first dominion which Adam had. Those that are living at its inception will be the first to walk up that highway, and then slowly others will be resurrected, and they too will begin to walk up that highway. Gradually, all mankind will have an opportunity to come back into harmony with God. They will begin to develop the ability to control their thoughts and their actions perfectly. Hearts will begin to change. Mankind will begin to see the benefit of God's way. They will learn to choose good over evil. Those who do choose good in harmony with God's way will be able to pass the test of that judgment day. They will be granted the right to live. Those who do not choose good will not have continuing life. For life is the gift of God and is conditional upon obedience to him. And when the work of the mediator is complete, the earth will be renewed, as we read in Isaiah. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come to mind. Isaiah 65:17. Okay, so this all sounds good. When can we expect this kingdom to begin? Well, not just yet. There's a couple of things that need to happen before the kingdom can begin. And I'm afraid that the bad news is that the conditions of the world will probably get worse before they get better. The prophet Joel speaks of this period of time and poetically describes it like this. A fire devoureth before them, and behind them a flame burneth. The land is as the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them a desolate wilderness. Joel 2, verse 3. Hebrews 12:26 tells us that this time is a period of shaking of both heaven and earth. And in verse 27, we're told that the purpose for this shaking is the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that have been made, so that the things which cannot be shaken may remain. In other words, we're currently in a period of transition. Unfortunately, the change from this world to the mediatorial kingdom will not come easily. But the good news is that mankind's extremity will be God's opportunity. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. The desire of all nations will come. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. So the question that you really need to ask yourself is, how can I best prepare for this incoming kingdom? And the answer is really not too hard to understand. Isaiah puts it this way: "Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. And let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon." Isaiah 55, verses 6 and 7. Ecclesiastes 12, verses 13 and 14 adds, "Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment, and every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil." And in the Psalms, we find a similar concern. "What man is he that desires life and loves many days, that he may see good? Keep thy tongue from evil and thy lips from speaking guile. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against them that do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth." And finally, in Micah chapter 6, we find a rhetorical question. "What should I offer unto God? What would he be pleased to receive from me?" The answer is given in verse 8. "What doth the Lord require of you, but to do justice, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God?" So then, the best way to prepare for the incoming kingdom is simply this: seek righteousness, seek justice, seek truth, develop kindness and mercy, develop love. Begin to act as if your life depended on how well you followed the golden rule, because eventually it will. May the Lord add his blessing.